air, online, from New York City, border to border, and coast to coast. You're connected with Tom Sullivan.
Well, look at that. Here we are. Yeah, you just like clockwork, isn't it? Welcome, welcome to the big radio show on this Wednesday, the 25th day of April, year of our Lord 2018. My name is Tom Sullivan. And we're going to go back to my old stomping grounds here in just a little bit. There is a, normally I don't do a lot of local crime stories, but this is a story which we're going to be joining law enforcement in a minute. It's called the Golden State Killer. He's also been dubbed the East Area Rapist. He's the also Los Angeles Times is calling him the original Night Stalker. This is a guy who has gone through, killed 12 people, so a serial killer, 45 rapes, more than 120 residential burglaries between 1976 and 1986. And they haven't seen or heard anything from this criminal since then. And today they have announced that they have arrested a 72-year-old man by the name of Joseph DeAngelo Jr. has been booked on suspicion of murder and being held without bail in Sacramento County, California. So the reason I said we go back to my old stomping grounds, normally I would not do a local story, but this is a guy who terrorized the entire state of California between 1976 and 1986. And I think you talk about true crime stories. I think the whole idea that police never give up, ever give up. This is a cold case. And I'm very anxious to hear how did they crack the case? It's been 40 years. And, I mean, this guy was a young, they had all kinds of two or three sketches of this guy, young guy, blonde hair. The sketches all kind of similar to each other. And now he's a 72-year-old man. I'm sure he doesn't look anything like what these sketches are like, but this is a guy who terrorized the state of California. I just think this is a testament to law enforcement and to the detectives who, and it goes from, he started off, and he lives in Sacramento County, but he also went around the San Francisco Bay Area, committing all kinds of crimes there, then to Southern California in Ventura County, and then also down to Orange County. So, I mean, this is a guy who has gone quite some distance, 300-400 miles distance, and how they could not find him then, but how they found him now is, to me, I mean, it's one of these great true crime stories. So we're waiting for the district attorney and the sheriff of Sacramento County. They're going to be holding a news conference here momentarily to announce this arrest of this guy. But I've got the timeline of crimes that this guy committed throughout California starting June 18th of 1976. Raped a woman. Then on July 17th, almost a month later, a teenage girl, then another teenage girl in August, then September, a woman who lives in the same city where he now lives. So it goes on through the Sacramento area for quite a few years, and then he branches, goes quiet, and then he all of a sudden shows up, same MO, shows up in the Bay Area. And starts attacking women there. He attacked some people in Modesto, California, in Davis, California, in Concord, Ignacio Valley, Concord, San Ramon, San Jose, Danville, Fremont, Walnut Creek. Then heads south to Santa Barbara in Goleta. and murdered a couple of people there, as well as rapes. It's Dana Point, very upscale neighborhood. Ventura County, Irvine, California, in Orange County. Goleta, again, back to Santa Barbara, and then back to Orange County. The last time he was seen committing a crime, or the evidence tied him to a crime, was May 4th of 1986, in which he raped and murdered a woman in Irvine, California. Thing about this guy was, and I can't see what's going on there, so are they gathering yet, Andy? Do you have a visual on this? No one at the podium yet. This guy, his crime spanned all across California. Alameda County, Contra Costa County, Santa Clara, Sacramento, Yolo, Stanislaus, San Joaquin, then down to Ventura County and Orange County. Amazing. Amazing that he did this. Now, what they were able to tie this guy together with is that what he would do, by the way, he was in law enforcement. He was a police officer in the town of Auburn, California. And he got fired from that department in 1979. So this was during his crime spree, after he shoplifted a can of dog repellent and a hammer from a drugstore. Strange. So the MO for the crime, it was very sadistic, but he would enter the home, and if the home had, they were all one stories. If there was a couple living inside, he would incapacitate the man first, binding him with strips of towels or shoelaces. He would then carefully balance a stack of dishes from the kitchen on the male victim's back. And that way, if the guy moved while he went and attacked the woman in the house, he would have a warning that the guy was moving. So this is a serial killer, serial rapist, one of the most prolific in the country. And it just shows that no matter what, they never gave up. They never gave up. I would imagine that detectives that were working on this 40 years ago are long gone, retired, and maybe have passed on by now. But apparently there was some new information regarding the case that came in. I was flipping around on TV over the weekend, and I flipped by, I don't know, A&E or one of those, Discovery, one of those that does true crime stories and all that sort of stuff. They I saw they had this the story about this guy, and again the he's been tagged with all kinds of different names: Golden State Killer, East Area Rapist, variety of the stalker. All right, so let's go. Who's this walking up? This is the District Attorney of Sacramento. Let's listen to what she has to say.
Don't know. My name is Anne Marie Schubert. I'm the District Attorney of Sacramento County. Before I start, I'd like to just do some introductions on who is here today. We have, in addition to myself, Sacramento Sheriff Scott Jones, Ventura County District Attorney Greg Totten, Orange County District Attorney Tony Rakakis, Contra Costa County District Attorney Dinah Becton, Alameda County District Attorney Nancy O'Malley, Sacramento FBI Special Agent in Charge Sean Regan, United States Attorney for the Northern District McGregor Scott, Assemblyman Jim Cooper, Bruce Harrington, the brother of Keith Harrington, Irvine Police Department Chief Mike Hamill, and our Crime Lab Director Chip Pollock. Let me first by saying this. The answer has always been in Sacramento. For over 40 years, countless victims have waited for justice. Over these years, hundreds of individuals have sought justice for these victims and their families. Many have dedicated their virtual entire professions to seeking this answer. For many of us, it was more than a professional commitment. It became personal for many of us. For me, here in Sacramento County, in June of 1976, I was 12. I grew up in the east area of Sacramento, near the cluster of where these crimes began. My sisters ranged from 10 to 16 at the time. As I have said many times over the last 18 years, at least for me, for us here in Sacramento, it was a time of innocence in 1976. No one locked their doors. Kids rode their bikes to school. Parents let their children play outside. The only thing we were told as a family was you just needed to be home before dark. We did not have things like cell phones or social media. And then for all of us here in this community that lived in this community during this time, it all changed. For anyone that lived here in this community here in Sacramento, the memories are very vivid. You can ask anyone that grew up here. Everyone has a story. But it must be remembered that it was not just Sacramento, that this case deeply affected this entire state. And then in June of 2016, at the 40th anniversary for the beginning of this series, the East Area Rapists, a press conference was held here in Sacramento, hosted by the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department and the FBI, attended by many agencies across California that have dedicated their careers and professions to coming to some kind of answer. The message was clear.
All right, so she's going over the history of the whole case. I want to find out how they cracked the case, and for local stations in California, they will continue with this. We will pick it up live after we take this short break. We'll be right back.
Opinions that matter. Radio that makes you think. Tom Sullivan.
Let's go back. The sheriff of Sacramento, Scott Jones, is talking right now. Let's listen.
Everything that I could to solve it, and had a lot of conversations early on with District Attorney Schubert about how we could do it. And those discussions really touched the passion of both of us to solve this case. Both of us committed the best and the brightest, our hand-picked folks, to oversee the resolution of this case and gave virtually unlimited resources and freedom to pursue whatever leads and technology currently existed. So I can tell you that over the last few days, as information started to point towards this individual, we started some surveillance, we were able to get some discarded DNA, and we were able to confirm what we thought we already knew, that we had our man. And yesterday afternoon, in a perfectly executed arrest, my detectives arrested James Joseph DeAngelo, 72 years old, living in Citrus Heights. I can tell you that although it was DNA, ultimately, that led us down the right road, there were a lot of places that road could have led. I don't want to underscore, I can't underscore enough, the absolute human factor. The dogged determination of not only the detectives working on this case, but the passion of the district attorney, myself, the community, and the victims. All too often we forget about about the victims.
We're going to get near the bottom of this half hour, but that's exactly right. I mean, I just am flabbergasted that a 40-year-old case could be busted. But here is why. He just said it, that only a few days ago, after 40 years, they were able to get some discarded DNA. And with that DNA, they were able to make a positive match to evidence, obviously, that they had from 40 years ago. And you hear so many stories about crimes that have taken place, and they have some DNA, and they put it on some shelf in some police warehouse somewhere, and nobody ever sees it again. But this is a guy, I don't know why he stopped, quite bluntly. I don't know where the psychology of this is. How can you go around as a serial killer, killing 12 people, 45 rapes, 120 residential burglaries, started in 1976, ended in 1986, and nothing since? Here's a guy living in a house next door sort of operation in a nice middle class neighborhood. That you wonder how they actually got to the point where they did some surveillance on this guy, got the discarded DNA, and then were able to match it up with crimes that took place 40 years ago. So I don't know how he came up on their radar, or maybe he was on their radar from a long time ago but never did anything about it. So hats off to the persistence of somebody who decided to keep going on this case from the 1970s and 80s. By the way, one of the victims, in fact, it was the last known victim that was raped and murdered. Let me just get my list of crimes out here. Janelle Lisa Cruz, raped and murdered in Irvine, California, 1986. That's in Orange County, not too far from Disneyland, for those of you getting don't know your California geography. Her brother must have some money because he bankrolled an initiative that was put on the ballot for the people of California to vote on, and they passed this in 2004, mandating the collection of DNA samples from people convicted or even arrested in felony cases. So in California, if you are arrested for a felony, they take your DNA and store it and put it in a database, which makes sense. So they were able to match up the DNA from this guy 40 years ago to what they have discovered from some discarded DNA from this guy who now is an old man, 72 years of age. They are putting up a photo of him now, and it looks, I mean, he's, you wouldn't recognize him from the sketches back 40 years ago. Let me put it that way. Age has a way of doing that. So hats off to the police, the district attorney's office, all the investigators, the FBI, everybody who worked on this case. But man, talk about a true crime story. 40 years later, they got the guy.
First Amendment 101. You're listening to Tom Sullivan.
Yes, you are. Thanks for coming by. Happy Wednesday to you. Just kind of amazing police work that has just been announced out in California. The Golden State Killer is one of the names he goes by. Also, East Area Rapist and the original Night Stalker. Because there's two Night Stalkers. There's another guy, Richard Ramirez, and I think, hasn't Richard Ramirez, I forgot to look it up, I think he's died in prison. But this is a guy who they have arrested for 12 killings, 45 rapes, more than 120 burglaries, residential burglaries, between 1976 and 1986. I don't know, for those of you that are in the psychiatrist business and mental health business, how does somebody do that, become a serial killer rapist, and then stop. I mean, you wonder, well, this is something that you would think he would keep doing until he was caught. The guy had been in law enforcement for a few years, so obviously savvy. He had also been in the Navy in Vietnam, so he had military background, but more importantly, law enforcement background, which I guess gave him enough information to on how police work to be able to elude a capture. But how did it? Why did he just stop? I mean, I presume that will come out. So they got this guy. I mean, he's an old-looking guy. He looks a lot older than his age. He's 72, but he looks like he's well into his 80s. His name's Joseph James DeAngelo, and he has lived in the same area where most of these crimes took place. He never moved. So this is. I don't know. I find the crime fascinating. The crime fascinating from the standpoint that they were so gruesome, and at the same time, never got caught, and at the same time came to a stop all over the state of California. So the original Night Stalker, the Golden State Killer, the East Bay Rapist, whatever name you want to put on him. Now he's a little old man. What they did not explain was how this guy came on their radar 40 years later. There is a story about a woman who was obsessed with this case and wrote a book about all of this, and She apparently was at the finish line of her book, and she died. So she's been working on this for decades. And apparently it may be where some information from that book that she was working on somehow was able to point the finger at this guy. It says, interest in the cold case was renewed following the release of the late author Michelle McNamara's crime novel, I'll Be Gone in the Dark. Her husband, who is an actor, Patton Oswalt, and her friend, Billy Jensen, took the book that she was just about finished with, published it after her death. It reached number one on the New York Times best-selling list last month. And that's maybe why this past weekend when I was flipping around on the TV, I saw there was a documentary about this East area rapist. So a book is out, became number one. Cable crime stories brought the story back again. And now, all of a sudden, bing, bang, boom, they say, okay, we've got some discarded DNA. They just started 6 days ago, the sheriff said. So, I don't know. But it's a fascinating, I mean, he started in Sacramento, went over to the East Bay, around the Bay Area of California, down to Southern California, down to Santa Barbara, down to Orange County, Irvine, California. All these rapes and murders. And the fact that he was kind of a smart criminal, putting dishes, making, if there was a man in the house, tie him up, put him on his stomach on the floor, and put dishes on his back while he went and raped or killed the woman in the house. But that way he knew if the guy got loose, if the dishes fell over. So... Well, it goes to one of my old theories about most criminals are stupid. And if you are fairly bright, I think, sadly, I think a fairly smart person can get away with all kinds of crimes. And this guy with a little bit of law enforcement background probably fits that bill. All right, one other court case. Well, there's a bunch of court cases. We got the Supreme Court and a bunch of different things to talk about today. But Bill Cosby's trial. Speaking of crimes, Cosby's retrial After all day closing arguments yesterday, the jury finally got the case and started deliberations this morning. And about 2 hours into deliberations, the jury's first question for the court was handed to the bailiff and read it to the judge, and it was one that the court could not answer. They asked the question, the jury in the Cosby trial asked the question, what is the legal definition of consent? And that's the question which they're going to have to determine. The court can't tell them that. They're going to have to determine whether or not this Andrea Constand, who is the woman who accuses Cosby of assault, sexual assault, that's the entire crux of the entire case. He's charged with 3 counts of aggravated indecent assault, stemming from Andrea Constand's accusations that the comedian molested her in 2004. There were many more descriptions of molestations and attacks by Cosby, but the statute of limitations has expired, not with this one. This was in 2004. So, as they do in trials, they have painted Andrea Constand as a money grabber and that she told somebody she was going to do this so she could get rich. They were trying to basically smear her reputation. So, this is why, and I believe the prosecutor in this case said, this is why women do not report a lot of these kinds of crimes. Because the defense team painted her as a con artist, a pathological liar, that she settled a civil lawsuit against Cosby for $3.3 million more than a decade ago. And those are the things that have the prosecutor going nuts, because the defense is smearing the woman who has made these accusations. So, Cosby's trial is underway, the retrial, I should say, in Pennsylvania. During the closing arguments yesterday, Cosby himself received a tongue lashing from the prosecutor after he appeared to be laughing and smiling while the prosecution made its argument. The prosecutor interrupted herself to say, "He's laughing like it's funny, but there's nothing funny about stripping a woman of her capacity to consent." So they will find out, but the jury is working on it. Don't know how long it'll take. The last time it went on for quite some time because they could not reach a decision, and it was a hung jury. All right, we got the DACA court order from a D.C. district judge. So stick around. We've got much more to talk about. Don't go away. My name is Tom Sullivan. We'll be right back.
Enjoy our discussion. You seem to be very fair. It's appreciated.
I just call him like I see him.
You're with Tom Sullivan.
Another court case for you, and this is DACA, and it's a very strange, curious order from a federal judge in the District of Columbia. This is back in February, Supreme Court, Jazz Shaw writing about this today. Supreme Court bailed on the DACA question, declining to hear an appeal from a San Francisco judge, to a ruling from a San Francisco judge. That San Francisco judge says, no, the president cannot end the DACA program. Well, that left the decision open for additional rulings, and a federal judge in D.C. has concluded that not only President Trump cannot terminate the program, but that the White House has only 3 months to come up with a better justification for its actions, or this federal judge in D.C. will order the full DACA program to go back into effect. I'm going, and this guy is judges John Bates. He's a George W. Bush appointee. It's just the oddest thing ever, because when does a program that was created by an executive order, it was never a piece of legislation, it was never passed by anybody that was an elected representative of the people, how does this take on the same level as a federal law? It was never crafted into law by Congress, and that's what Donald Trump said, I want you to do, is go take this thing, Congress, and do it right. The way it stands right now, it probably never will be, but it was brought into existence by President Obama with the stroke of a pen. So how does a judge say that the President of the United States cannot modify it or terminate it? And taking it one step further, the judge here has set a dangerous precedence which Democrats should be cautious about celebrating, because does this mean that all of Donald Trump's executive orders are now written in stone? That's the thing about executive orders. They can be undone by the next president. But by this judge's ruling, it would give precedence to the fact that no future presidents can change what previous presidents have done. So if a Democrat president comes along and tries to roll back any of Trump's regulations, well, then all you got to do is go to court and say, hey, this new president cannot undo what the previous president put in pen and ink. So this has to go back to the Supreme Court. And they got to take another crack at this thing. They cannot push it off. If they want to uphold these rulings, they are going to have to fundamentally change the nature of presidential power and executive orders. And that is certainly a case to be made in favor of that idea, since so many of these actions have the force of law without any input of lawmakers doing anything about it. So if it's going to be what this judge says, then it must be applied across the board to all future presidents. This makes no sense. This judge not only says that DACA, you can't terminate the program, President Trump, and you got 3 months, or we're going to order the whole darn DACA program back into effect. I don't know how a judge can do that, because that means the judge is now becoming a legislator. And like I said, this is an appointee of George W. Bush. This did not come from the Ninth Circuit Court. This is at the federal district level in Washington, D.C. But this whole ruling just makes it very, 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 very strange. And then the other big courthouse story today is that the travel ban 3.0 went back before the Supreme Court today. And they are going to, they listened to a bunch of arguments. It appears, but it's dangerous to do this, but it appears as if the liberal judges are going, what about what Donald Trump said when he was a candidate? What about what he said about Muslim bans when he was a candidate? They kept asking those kinds of questions about what he said when he was a candidate. The Solicitor General said, he wasn't an official. He wasn't a government official. And since he's been a government official, he has gone back on those things that he talked about having Muslim bans and all that. He's actually changed his mind. So besides that, he had no authority when he was a candidate. Now that he has authority, he has taken back a lot of those words, and they have crafted together a travel ban that affects only 8% of Muslims in the world, because it's only certain countries, and not all of them are Muslim-majority countries. Some are, some are not. So the judges went back and forth on this, but it looks like from the questioning that the conservative side of the court, and then throw in Justice Kennedy, and throw in the Chief Justice, and both of them were asking questions that made it sound like they were going to rule in favor of President Trump's travel ban. I think it's been watered down. I think by the time you get to this point on the calendar, you go, isn't it kind of a thing of the past? Has it really done anything? Because what's been going on is what my suggestion from the beginning, which was just increase your vetting. People from those countries, just vet them to the nth degree. So they're going to hear it, and we'll get a decision in June. So we don't know about this travel ban 3.0. They did say on an emergency basis, go ahead and you can keep the travel ban in effect until we rule on it, but they're not going to rule on it until June. But meantime, the travel ban that Donald Trump wanted, 3.0, the third version of it, has actually been looking like it's being received pretty well. So there's the Solicitor General on this did a very good job. And he talked about how not only has the president stepped back from his previous comments as a candidate, but they also have exceptions, that 430 exceptions that have been granted. So the Solicitor General said, we are doing this basically very carefully and making sure that people that it should not apply to, it's not applied to. So at 11 o'clock in the morning, the Chief Justice said the case has been submitted. So we will find out in June whether or not the travel ban goes into effect. I'm not sure it means all that much difference because I think they're cracking down at the border, at points of entry, especially at the airports. All right. So we've got all of that. And we've got the doctor, Ronnie Jackson. We talked a little bit about it yesterday. That whole story is blowing up to be much bigger today. We'll talk about that and much more when we come back.